This podcast is sponsored by Cellar Plan from Berry Brothers and Rudd, collecting fine wines for future drinking.
Hello and welcome to the Spectator podcast. I'm Lara Prendergast, and on this week's episode, we'll be looking at the Brexit divisions within their historical context. We'll also be debating the future of driverless cars, and finally, we'll be learning about how to navigate the turbulent waters of modern dating. First up, Christmas is a good time to count our blessings, or at least put our problems into perspective. And as Professor Robert Toombs says in the Christmas issue of The Spectator, Brexit has brought great strain on our communities, but we can and must resist it. Robert joins me now, along with our political editor, James Forsyth. So, Robert, do you think the country has ever been as divided as it is right now?
Yes, quite often. And I think probably the 1970s would be an obvious example. Going back further, it's much, much worse. We'd probably all think of the 1930s, we'd probably think of the Suez Crisis, we might, those of us with an interest in history, might think about the early 1900s. So I don't think our level of division now is unusual, but it is rather surprising, it seems to me, because it's about so little.
James, why do you think people have suddenly started to be so divided over this issue of Brexit?
I think Robert hits the nail on the head when he says it's over so little. What I think is interesting is that during the referendum campaign, it was amazing how the pro-EU side kept saying, well, no one on our side is talking about joining the single currency. No one on our side is talking about Schengen. We're against a European super state too. So why then does this change in the nature of the relationship, which if you do not wish to be part of the ultimate aim of the European project of ever closer union, is really not that dramatic? Why has it triggered such dramatic feelings? I think it is partly because people don't realise what they have until they're gone. Partly, I think it's because some people made a tactical argument. So they did actually really secretly dream of one day waking up to find the euro and being the currency of a land and Britain taking its place at the kind of European top table and all that. But they thought it was politique to be quiet about that. And then I might, if I was trying to be troublesome, and I mean there is some truth to this, I think it's also because a lot of the people who lost the referendum are on a side that nearly always win political arguments, one way or the other. So losing was a very new experience to them, and one that particularly stuck in the craw.
Do you think it's more of a cultural divide than a political divide?
Yes, I think it is, and I think it's very much, it brings out divisions within ourselves, because the thing that strikes me very much about the debate is how little is about Europe itself, or about the EU. Very few people defended the EU during the referendum campaign. It was mainly about the dangers of leaving it. Very few people express any opinion about the future of Europe or about its problems or its instabilities. It's as if Europe exists at some Olympian level, unchanging, perfect, and that we are therefore tearing ourselves away from this solid and permanent structure. Whereas I think anyone who knows or takes an interest in the EU knows how unstable it is economically and politically, and how much it has to change if it's to survive at all. And yet these changes are ones that we would never have wanted to be part of. And so in a sense, leaving the EU, which is of course what we voted to do, is recognising, it seems to me, the reality of a very changing Europe, and a Europe that's changing in directions that we would never really have accepted.
I think we also joined the EU, always claiming that, oh, don't worry about all those words about ever closer union. You know, they're just a continental rhetorical flourish. They don't mean anything more than that. When actually they did mean it. And the problem is that we've always viewed the EU in an incredibly instrumental way. It's a kind of, and it is even now in this debate, it's all about the single market and the customs union, not about the concept of European citizenship or European political unity. I think one of the things that I found depressing in the time since the debate is a number of people who say almost as a boast, but they don't know anyone who voted a different way to them. When a country votes 52-48, if your entire social circle and your entire friendship group all voted the same way, it should make you worry that you're guilty of groupthink. Because if you don't know anyone who voted the other way, or no one who voted the other way dares tell you that they did, it suggests that your group isn't actually embracing the kind of full diversity of a country.
I hardly know anyone who voted the same way, but I certainly get your point. I've often talked to people, or more often people have talked to me about this, and it seems that often people's idea of why the EU is important to them is very personal. It's about travel, it's about owning property somewhere, it's about their children going on Erasmus schemes, it's about getting funding for their research and so on in academic circles. And it seems to me this is not really a very good way of deciding great national issues. We ought to be able to look rather beyond our own particular interest to the general interest. And I think we haven't been very good at doing that. Perhaps not terribly good on either side.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of truth to that. I also think part of the problem is that we don't actually understand European politics as well as we should. Now, I would say this, wouldn't I, having voted to leave, but I think if we understood European politics better, I actually suspect that more people might have voted to leave. By which I mean, if you look at, A, where Europe will need to go politically, and also what is taken for granted at a European level. There was a thing in the last European Parliament elections called the Spitzenkandidaten debates, where the candidates of each of the major political groupings in Europe advanced their arguments about the future direction of Europe. And they weren't shown in Britain on the BBC. And I mean, that was a real pity. And that was because, you know, the Tories weren't part of the main group and there's not a huge appetite for European political programming in prime time. But what is striking about when you watch those debates is, regardless of which political faction they represent, their answer to every question is more Europe. They view everything as having a federal answer, whether that is a federal left-wing answer in the case of a socialist or a more Christian Democrat European answer in the case of a European People's Party. And I think that is one of the things that we fail to appreciate. British Prime Ministers have come back from Europe endlessly saying Europe is going our way. It's not. We had some tactical successes in slowing things down. We had some tactical successes in negotiating opt-outs. But the fundamental aim of the project of ever closer union, you just need to look at how much closer to realisation that is now than it was either at the time of the Treaty of Rome or when Britain joined the European Economic Community.
What worries me about this is not that there will be a European superstate which will dominate us or we'll be left out of, but that the attempts to create something, well, of course, people often reject the phrase European superstate, but Emmanuel Macron called it a sovereign Europe in his recent important speech, is something that will simply not happen. Or if it does happen, it will cause all sorts of political problems. Because what people in all the European countries will find, I think I'm sure we agree about this, is that the things that they can vote for have become less and less important. And the decisions that they can influence are fewer and fewer. Macron is very clear. He thinks the only way to save Europe is, as you say, not only more Europe, but a huge amount more Europe in defence matters, in security, in immigration, in education, in taxation, in welfare, in labour law. Everything is to be ironed out at a European level, and that, he thinks, is the only way that Europe can be made to work. But are all the electorates of all these European countries going to simply accept the fact that things are being taken out of their hands and out of the hands of their elected representatives? It seems to me that they won't, and they don't. In a sense, the idea is to present them with a sort of fait accompli, and then once they've tasted it, they'll like it. I think there's no evidence for that, and it seems to me that Europe is rushing forward, a sort of forward flight, trying to get away from its problems by going further and further into dangerous waters.
And do you think that's slightly foolish, given that the British have just voted to leave the EU? Do you think it's a foolish position for Macron to take?
Well, as James says, people in Europe who support the idea, and of course they're not in all countries even a majority, but they're certainly a majority of those who hold positions of influence, think that the only thing you can do is to go forward. If you start stopping or going backwards, then the whole thing will fall apart. And that's why Brexit is seen as such a danger.
I also think this sounds like a kind of conspiracy theory, but it's not. But they deliberately created a single currency in the belief that this would force you to create the political structures that would follow. They knew that if they proposed the political structures first and then the currency, they never would have managed to get popular sign-off to that. But by proposing the currency and then using crises to push forward further integration, you can succeed. I mean, at the risk of quoting Robert Bach to himself, there was a very telling point, I think, in one of your earlier pieces of The Spectator about Brexit, which is actually when it comes to Europe, the French divide over Europe is much more bitter than the British divide over Europe. And one of the things that does worry me, as Robert said, that the way in which European politics is being pursued is that you are going to end up pitting these two visions directly against each other. That you are going to end up with a kind of Macron vision of here's what we need for Europe, you know, much more done at a European level, versus a kind of sovereigntyist, goalist vision. And it is going to be a kind of epoch clash. It's not going to be like our referendum, where people are saying, well, we'll be half in over here and half out over there, if you see what I mean. It's going to be a much more fundamental argument.
Yes, I agree. You know, a country like France, and not only France, the choice becomes, those who are sceptical about Europe have no choice but to vote for an extreme party. It can be the extreme right, as in France, or it could be the extreme left, as in Greece. But there's not really a sort of middle constitutional way of stopping this process or trying to get out of it. And I think one of the important things about Brexit for European governments is that only by making Brexit look a disaster, which it's been universally presented as far as I can see, in the European media, can they deter their own people from wanting to go that way too. We saw that with in France when Marine Le Pen, who was at least as Eurosceptic as Nigel Farage, suddenly had to change direction before the election because people suddenly thought, well, we're in the Eurozone, and if we leave the Euro, what's going to happen to our savings? She had to give that up. And of course, the idea is that leaving the EU or leaving the Euro is a terribly dangerous thing which will cause huge economic disruption and political upheaval. And therefore, even if you don't like it, you've got to live with it. And hence, if you've got to live with it, you might as well push it forward and try to make it work. So I think that they're sort of caught in a kind of cul-de-sac. There's no way out. The only way is to go forward.
I think one of the things as well, which we've been struck by, is a lot of our media coverage says, oh my word, look at what Mark Rutte, the Dutch Prime Minister, says about Brexit. And he's quite Eurosceptic. If he thinks it's this bad, what does everyone else think? Well, he has to portray it as particularly bad because he has a growingly Eurosceptic public. If you look at the Eurobarometer polling that Robert quotes in his article, the Dutch public is moving in a distinctly more Eurosceptic direction. So he has to say, look over there, look at how appallingly Britain has done since leaving, to try and persuade people back in Holland that you really shouldn't flirt with any party that talks about leaving the Euro or any other kind of Eurosceptic position.
Yes.
Robert, how do you think historians in the future will look back at Brexit?
Well, it depends on what happens next. Sorry, that's an easy way out. Well, if things go very badly, then they could go very badly indeed. We could see the breakup of the United Kingdom, we could see the wreckage of our present party system, we could see the breakup of the Tory party and so on, we could see Jeremy Corbyn in power. Okay, in that case it will be seen as one of the major political crises of recent history. If, on the other hand, we come out with something reasonably acceptable, then it could either be seen as a simple bump in the road. We've been moving away from Europe anyway economically for more than a decade, which is what seems to be very difficult to persuade people of, but we have. We haven't been, as James said, we've refused all the integrationist projects. So we would in any case be left on the sidelines, if that's the right word for it. It may be seen that this was just an inevitable and natural development of our previous history. I think it should be the latter, but I don't think one can rule out things going badly wrong.
I mean, the tripos question will be something like, from the moment that Britain decided not to join the single currency, its departure from the European Union was inevitable. Yeah. Because the nature of Britain's self-perception is that we are a leading player in whatever organisation we are a member of. As soon as we decided not to join the single currency, the single biggest project of the European Union, it was impossible for us to be a leading player in the EU, unless the EU split into a kind of two-tier body with an inner ring and an outer ring.
Which some people would like.
Yes, no, where we could lead the outer ring. But because the European Union wasn't doing that, I think it was inevitable that Britain would leave, because you couldn't maintain the fiction that we were leading in an organisation where, on its most important project, we weren't a member.
So perhaps future historians will look back on the decision not to join the Euro as the...
Yeah, I mean, that is the moment. I mean, that is... Yeah. I think if you go back, the moment when history reached a turning point and failed to turn was when Blair won in 1997 and decided not to hold a referendum on joining the Euro. Because at the peak of his powers, he probably could have got that through. Yeah. And then I think if we joined the Euro, I think we would be in the same predicament as the Dutch, where we might not like it, but we'd be so far in that you couldn't win the argument about leaving.
No.
And I think it's that fact that we didn't join the single currency. From that moment on, I think Britain's departure from the European Union became more and more likely. I think the only question was whether we formally left the European Union before the European Union left us.
So that's Gordon Brown's claim to a footnote in history.
Indeed.
Thank you, James, and thank you, Robert.
What are you drinking this weekend? Start a cellar plan with Berry Brothers and Rudd, and soon you could be uncorking something out of the ordinary. To start your cellar collection, visit bbr.com/cellarplan.
Next. For this year's Christmas conversation, we sat down two people with very different ideas about the future of personal transport. Rory Sutherland is optimistic about driverless cars, but Christian Wolmer thinks they're a pipe dream that will never be realised. Here they are in conversation.
I think this is a technology that will never happen, and there's been a fantastic amount of hype about it, but very little substance. And the reason I say that is we're at a very low level at the moment. There are no driverless cars. There may be some driverless cars without a driver in them going around Phoenix in a very limited way, but the owners, Waymo, which is Google, are very secretive about precisely what they're doing. All the rest of the driverless car experiments are actually cars with drivers in them, with the driver able to take over in an emergency. Now, when we start looking at what the world that is promoted by this mix of auto manufacturers and tech companies who are promoting this idea, when you start to look at it, they say, right, we're all going to be in driverless pods, they're going to be electric, and they're going to be shared use. This is a triple revolution that I think is completely fanciful. The problem is that the advantages of these driverless cars only come about if they have that revolution. Because congestion, for example, is not solved by the fact of whether a car is driverless or not. Congestion will only be solved if you have fewer cars. Well, you'll only have fewer cars if we decide to all share them. But there is no idea amongst the consumers that they want to share their cars. You know, we could do it at the moment. We could all use Ubers instead of having our own cars. But we like having our car, our golf clubs in the car. We like having the baby seat. We like having the radio tuned to Radio 4. So this is just a complete fantasy that will go the way of the jetpacks that used to be in the Beano that I read in the 1960s when I was a kid.
I'm perhaps less sceptical than you are. I think there are gains, intermediate gains, not least in highway safety. That may well be cars that are more or less driven by a human being, but which are much less capable of causing harm. I think we can reasonably be optimistic about that.
I can't be, but I'll come back to that.
But I mean, generally, I think what you've seen in aviation, for example, is a very judicious mixture of automation and human control, which over many years gets perfected and the balance gets improved. And I think we can see something similar there. I'd be too pessimistic if I doubted that actually road safety would improve on the basis of technology. Where I entirely agree with you is that there is this extraordinarily small patch of the planet in California, which is generally populated by the world's most credulous people, whom we indulge to an incredible degree. Okay, so we actually indulge their bizarre rocketry fantasies. We indulge the fact that they're invested into such a level that they're not required to make any money. And then they're praised for being disruptive. Now, my argument, if you look at Uber, for example, or if you look at Amazon, if you give me £40 billion and don't require me to make any money, I can disrupt any industry you choose to name. It doesn't require a huge amount of skill to do that. Now, you know, Amazon is, to some extent, unfair competition for British retailers for the simple reason that it isn't required to make any money because it's of both tax complications that actually it's more lucrative for its investors to have capital gains than actual earnings, and the fact that it's indulged to that extent. Now, if Amazon were run by the Ministry of Retail, people would have demanded that it was closed down immediately if it had been the product of government subsidies. But because it's the product of subsidies by overindulgent tech investors, we somehow regard this as okay. And we allow a very, very small subdivision of people to design the future for us. And they're insanely optimistic in many cases, and they're also possessed of various Jetsons fantasies that they've grown up with.
But you think that there is some advantage to the concept of driverless cars, that they can be delivered?
I have a car at the moment which has a thing called adaptive cruise control. And effectively, you set the maximum speed for the car. It then has a kind of radar sensor at the beginning, and it keeps a predetermined distance away from the car in front and therefore effectively moderates its speed up to the set maximum according to the speed of the car in front. This makes motorway driving, I would argue, both a bit safer for me, but also makes it a degree easier.
This is nowhere near driverless.
Except for the fact that actually on a motorway you could take adaptive cruise control, simply add a metal wire along each lane so that my car stayed in the same lane. You could create convoy motoring quite easily. In fact, you could do it now, if it weren't for legal obstacles. So there are certain forms of motoring which I think will enable people to form road trains.
But do you envisage that this will then develop into cars that can operate in more complex environments than motorways?
I don't know. This is the strange thing, which is, you might argue that actually a large number of driver hours, particularly if you're a trucker, are effectively spent on America's interstate system. If you allowed truckers to essentially, whether the trucks were electric or diesel powered, if you allowed them essentially just to latch on electronically to a truck in front, and the person could then reasonably relax, assuming the driver at the very front wasn't a deranged lunatic, I can imagine that you could extend driver hours through that technology quite easily. Whether a car with no human inside can be trusted to go and navigate a complicated cityscape is a little tougher to ask, and the answer may well be no.
Let's go, first of all, with what you said about partial control. Now, in the driverless car world, there are six levels of autonomy. Right, they stretch from level naught, which is pretty much a very basic, a 2CV, let's say, or a very basic car, through to one which has a few helpful things and things that might ping at you if there's a danger or something, through to two where you have a lot of driver aids and you can reverse maybe and so on without taking control. And then you get to level three. Now, level three is completely problematic. Level three is where actually you'll be able to drive or be driven by this car for about 80 or 90% of the time. But you have to be alert at all times because the car is not ready to deal with all situations. Now, Ford started making these cars and testing them, and found that what happened was that on the highways, the drivers fell asleep because it was too boring, because they were, yes, you know, they were basically in cruise control, the speed was set, there weren't very many
I'm okay
cars.
Because I'm still steering.
Okay, level three involves, no, you don't have to steer, it can stay in the lane.
I'm level two then, I guess.
Right,
yeah.
So you're more level two. Level three is you actually have markings on the road and it follows a particular lane and so on, and can even switch lane, you know, if it needs to overtake and that sort of thing. So it's quite sophisticated. But Ford found that, first of all, the drivers fell asleep. So then they put two drivers in there. And then they tried having seats which kind of rattled, you know, every now and then to keep the driver awake, or things that flashed at the driver. And they abandoned level three. They decided that level three was actually more dangerous. So what you were describing there is actually more dangerous than a car that we control all the time.
I mean, what certainly the civil airliner manufacturers discovered is you have this fundamental problem with an autopilot, which if it hands over very hastily to a less than alert pilot...
Yes, exactly.
You create
that.
This catastrophic kind of hiatus, which is everything's going fine, the autopilot's flying the plane, suddenly the pitot tube freezes over so that it doesn't have a correct measure of altitude or airspeed.
This is the Air France crash.
Air France crash. Right. And then what happens is the pilot essentially goes from playing with his laptop to sheer white-knuckle terror and chaos in the space of 1 second, and at which point actually capturing with time to spare what really is going on and what you need to do is hugely different. So there is that fundamental problem with autopilots, which is a lot of people say, well, most remaining air crashes are the result of pilot error, but that's because when an autopilot can't cope, it hands over to a pilot. And it often hands over to a pilot in a very unforgiving way. And it might even be handing over to a pilot who, because he spent most of his flying hours with an autopilot, has lost the basic intuitive skills that, say, a Sullenberger has when it comes to landing a plane in a river.
That was Christian Wolmer and Rory Sutherland. And for more from their discussion, do pick up a copy of The Spectator's bumper Christmas issue. And finally, for the young heterosexual Spectator man, the dating world is beset with perplexities. It was all so different in his father's era, where making a pass was not seen by women as harassment or assault, but as par for the course on the romance-seeking circuit. Luckily, though, in this year's Christmas issue, Mary Killen has provided a helpful guide to modern flirting. Mary joins me now. Mary, you mentioned in your piece Freddie F., age 26, and we haven't actually been able to track him down, but we've roped in our deputy editor, Freddie G.
Manfully entering the breach.
He's going to put some of these questions to you. So, Fred, should we start with the first one?
Yes. On the rare occasion that I'm getting on well with a girl, I've often given her shoulder or knee a light touch, partly to emphasise a point in conversation, but also to let her know I'm keen. Is this now not on? Are there any safe spaces on a person's body I can respectfully lay a hand on? Or should I keep my hands to myself?
Well,
I think he should keep his hands to himself.
Well, touching the knee is dodgy. but touching the shoulder or arm in a social situation is fine, even in today's hashtag MeToo culture. The gesture cannot be construed as sexual harassment. Moreover, when girls' arms are exposed in fine weather, a seemingly harmless brush of skin on skin is key to diagnosing attraction. The French have a saying, l'amour, c'est une question de peau. If the girl is interested, you should be able to sense it from her reaction. Her skin may goose pimple, or she may blush. If she's open to further skin brushing, she'll keep her arm in proximity to yours. If not, she may roll down her sleeves and keep her arms close to her side.
What if Freddie F. can't sense it from her reaction? Just stay on the safe side, you'd say?
I think you might have to do more groundwork.
More groundwork?
More lunches. I tell you a very good tip. A friend of mine didn't know whether the woman he eventually married fancied him or not. And so he took her out to dinner. This was the fifth date. He went without a jacket. So when they left the restaurant, he was cold. And he said, oh, my God, it's freezing. Can I hug you? Can I share your coat? And she said, yes. And the way her body moved in towards his told him she would not repulse any further overtures.
Mary, I'm going to ask you this next one because I think this is a question that is sort of universal about lunging in taxis. And obviously there's this phrase, not safe in taxis. What's your advice about, or for men wanting to lunge?
Okay, the marker. Is it safe to lunge at a girl in a taxi? Well, first of all, is her bag placed as a bulwark between you and her? Secondly, are her legs crossed and her arms folded? Well, that suggests she doesn't want you to lunge. But if, on the other hand, she's made a space between you both and her legs are uncrossed and her arms unfolded and her head is thrown back as she looks at you, I think it's fairly safe to assume, provided you've done flirting earlier, that you can make a tentative lunge.
That's a green light.
Yes.
I wish I had done this stuff earlier. It'd be very handy.
Can you use the motion of the taxi as a sort of way to...
Good idea, good point. If you go roughly round corners where you're thrown together, that's very good.
I think that's maybe easier in a black cab than in a Uber.
It is much easier.
Well, pay the driver a bit extra to drive.
Rashly round Hyde Park corners so that you're flung together.
Career round.
I mean, in the olden days, girls used to dream about being stuck in lifts with men they fancied. Because if you are stuck in a confined space for a long time, obviously the inevitable will happen if the two are attracted to each other. These days, everyone's so frightened and shy of causing offence or being rejected and various other things. Needs a bit of encouragement.
Should men pay for a woman's dinner?
Unbelievably to me, my panel of junior consultants said that 60% of them would be annoyed if the man tried to pay because they felt it would impugn their own sense of potency and they don't like the idea that the man might expect a favour in return. But that's only 60%. So I think there's no need for the man to insist on paying. You just have to play it by ear.
What about offering to split, or is that...
Yes, that's fine.
That's okay.
The Vanishing Act, which is about Freddie F's colleague, Hugo. My colleague, Hugo, is a bit of a goer. He meets a lot of girls on dating apps, but then doesn't see them more than once. Hugo asks, I know that many girls complain that boys they've met once after hooking up online just vanish afterwards, leaving them confused. Is it kinder, perhaps, to be clearer? Should I text a date and say I had a lovely time, but I just don't fancy you enough to repeat the experience? Good luck.
Well, my view is that full intimacy should not have taken place on the first date in any case. As the late Mark Boxer once remarked, it's the height of bad manners to sleep with a woman only once. But nobody should be in that position. The people shouldn't arrive at the position where they're kind of mating, like barnyard animals, after a few hours. They should get to know each other first. However, we know that in today's drunken Tinder culture, it does happen. It's very, very rude to say to a girl, I didn't fancy you, thank you. So try not to get into that situation in the first place, because a girl could accept being dumped or ghosted following a drunken encounter in a nightclub. but for a man to go to all the trouble of 3 hours of chatting first and implying that he's come to like her is deeply wounding if she hears nothing again.
You mentioned drunkenness. How much do you think today's consent culture and all the problems around it are related to the fact that young people are getting very, very drunk together in ways that they weren't perhaps 40, 50 years ago?
I think it is a problem. Mind you, we've always been drunk, but I think the young are drunker now than my age group was. I saw only yesterday at lunchtime a girl sitting with about a pint of wine in a hotel in Westminster and a man next to her. It was midday.
Well...
Might have been someone from the Spectator.
Let's hope that ended. Let's hope that ended well.
For a man, how many women can they be dating at once?
I think they can. Well, with this Tinder culture, I think it's fine to be interviewing applicants, as you might put it, you know, four at a time. But no, I don't think you should have full intimacy until you've decided one person, you like them, and you're going to just be exclusive towards them. It's rude to be having full intimacy with more than one person at the same time.
A bit of lunging here. What is the correct response if you lunge at a girl and she ducks? Freddie F. once had the experience of lunging at a girl and she moved out the way very quickly and his face went into a wall. How do you avoid that happening?
Well, you make sure that your advances will be accepted by first leaning in and then lightly brushing the girl's hair. And if she recoils in horror, you go no further and say, sorry, there's a bit of twig or something in your hair, I was just removing it. But if she looks at you appealingly, you have the all clear.
Don't think there's a danger with that sort of soft advance that it comes across a bit creepy?
Only creepy if you don't fancy the man, but if you do fancy him, you'll welcome it.
Right.
Finally, we've got, am I a cad or just polyamorous? What's the difference between being a cad and being polyamorous?
I think it's pretentious to say you're polyamorous. It just means you're pushing your luck and kind of keeping all your options open for various reasons to appeal to all sorts of people that you might be sucking up to. And nobody really is polyamorous. I mean, like 1% maybe. But to say you are is pretentious.
Down with polyamory.
Down with polyamory.
May I say, as a final point, that the ideal situation for young men and women to get together and sort of gauge whether they fancy each other is slow dancing, because once your body is pressed up against someone else's, it's either rigid or compliant. And there's anyone in a big house party can put on a record, slow waltzes, and invite people to take to the dance floor over Christmas and New Year.
Thank you, Mary, and thank you, Freddie. That's all for this week. You can subscribe to the podcast on the iTunes store or by visiting spectator.co.uk/podcast. And you can also subscribe to our other shows, including Coffeehouse Shots, our politics podcast that will be keeping you up to date with breaking news over the festive season, although hopefully there won't be too much. And if you enjoy the podcast, why not pick up the magazine? You can read all the features discussed, as well as great pieces by Henry Marsh, Michael Lewis and Lionel Shriver. And we've got a special Christmas offer for podcast listeners. You can get a year's subscription to The Spectator for just £99 instead of the usual £135. It's the perfect gift for a podcast fanatic who wants to try the new fad straight out of 15th century Germany, printed word. And if you use this deal, we'll even throw in a free bottle of Berry Brothers and Rudd champagne. Just go to spectator.co.uk/Christmas podcast offer to claim your deal. Thanks for listening, and do join us again next week, where we'll be reviewing the events of 2017.